folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Sarah Pearson, my co-host, is here. Kathy Gellis and Michael Lissack join us. We're going to talk about some apps that are taking a very interesting approach to social problems and whether bullying and sexual assault might be in the crosshairs because of them. We're going to talk about a new Computer Fraud and Abuse Act case out of the Ninth Circuit and Ashley Madison misusing the DMCA, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 317, recorded August 28th, 2015. Law of the Whopper. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/twill. Hi, folks, and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. I'm here with my co-host, Sarah Pearson. Hello, Sarah. Great to see you.
Hey, great to see you. I'm glad that we're finally back together. It's been a few weeks.
I know, me too. It's great to reconnect. Sarah, if you did not listen to last week's show, hosted for the first time on her own and did a bang-up job, you've got to go catch it if you did not already. Great Ashley Madison and other discussions in last week's show that I thoroughly enjoyed. It's fun to be an audience member for the show for a change. And but it's great to be back, always chatting with you every Friday, as we do, about all the cutting edge issues at the intersection of technology and law. And we have a really couple of excellent guests joining us today. Michael Lissack is somebody who we've talked about on the show before, because back in July, we first discussed his We Consent app that he developed. And at that point, when we thought it was so interesting that we talked about it on the show, I decided, hey, we should really reach out to him and try and get him on. So I'm so glad that we were able to do that. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
In addition to being a very interesting and innovative app developer, and we're going to talk in a few moments about various apps that Michael has put out that attempt to address social issues with technology, social problems. So we're going to get into the details of those momentarily as soon as I introduce our other guest and give you some background on both of them. Michael is the executive director of the Institute for the Study of Coherence and Emergence. He's president of the American Society for Cybernetics, ISCE Professor of Meaning in Organizations, a visiting fellow at Hull University Business School, and an affiliate member of the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. So really quite a mouthful there, and a very interesting background you've got, Michael.
Well, hopefully it didn't take up the entire show just reading titles.
No, not at all. That's the thing I love about our show is we've got plenty of time and we always do a deep dive on our topics. So also joining us today is Kathy Gellis, who is an internet law practitioner. She's an attorney. Her particular expertise is in copyright and other IP issues, web host and intermediary liability and immunity, and other online free speech and internet law questions. Hello, Kathy. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So we are good to go. And I think we should start the conversation right with these apps, one of which we've certainly discussed on the show before. It's called We Consent, and it attempts to address the social problem of sexual assault. So let's start there. First of all, Michael, my hat's off to you. I think it's so creative. And you've come under a lot of fire for this, but I think it's so creative to try and address social problems in a way that is current for people, a way that involves tools that they have on them all the time, like their phone, and maybe just tries, as you've said in various interviews about your app, to change the conversation at minimum that people might be having around consent. Tell us what made you come up with the We Consent app and what it does.
Okay. One thing that's very important is we should never talk about We Consent app by itself. Mm-hmm. It's part of a suite. And while We Consent allows people to record that they agree and that they say yes, it's very important to realize that there's also a No app called What About No. And everyone always has the right to change their mind. And if they do change their mind, there is an app for that as well. And so the We Consent app does not stand on its own, but is part of a suite. Now, what got me to do this...
Just to round out the suite, there's also a Changed Mind app?
That one is coming. And more important than Changed Mind, courtesy of all of the feedback, we are also working on another app that's called I've Been Violated. Mm. And should the unfortunate event occur, the statistics say that 85% of victims do not want to speak to health, school, or legal authorities right afterwards. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with not having a conversation right afterwards is whenever that person does decide to speak up, there could be credibility questions. We could go all the way to Bill Cosby to see what that's like. Mm-hmm. But what we've done instead is with the I've Been Violated app, whenever the victim feels that he or she is in a safe place, she can reach for her phone. She records her name, a version of what happened, who did it, and then that gets encrypted and locked up and again is only available to appropriate authorities or upon subpoena. But this way, if it's 6 months, a year, whatever the time period is, there is a piece of contemporaneous evidence that's been geocoded for location, time-stamped, and encrypted. So when you go to tell your story, there is something that was recorded within a few minutes of the event.
And that can be important for the prosecutors in a case or the triers of fact in a case and getting evidence admitted in court that it's recorded close to when the event occurred has significance for that. Tell us about We Consent. Let's start with that one and then we can talk about the suite of apps that go with it. What is its purpose and what made you think to approach this via a cell phone app?
All right. So the way this started was that during Christmas week of last year, I live in Boston, and the Harvard faculty was debating fairly vigorously whether to switch to a standard of preponderance of evidence from beyond a reasonable doubt with regard to 9 sexual assault cases. And the Harvard Law School faculty was adamant that this would be a denial of due process. They did not want the university to do it. And there was about $10 million on the line. Come New Year's, money won, the Harvard Law School faculty did not win, and Harvard adopted the preponderance of evidence standard. This was a lot of press in Boston, and I'm reading this from my background, and I'm saying, there's got to be a better way. If you want to do something that requires a demonstration that there has been consent, you need something more than just he said, she said. And what's the first thing that I thought of is what is it that every college student has within 2 or 3 feet of them at almost all times? Their cell phone. So that meant that at least to me, it seemed obvious to do an app that indicated a mutual yes. And as I said a minute ago, you can't have an app that indicates yes unless you also have an app that allows somebody to indicate no if or when they change their mind.
Mm-hmm. We got a question in IRC on the question of separating those functions. Why did you decide to have a separate app for indicating a lack of consent?
Well, first off, the apps can be on different partners' phones. It's important that the No app be on the phone of the person who wants to say no. The Yes app could be a phone of either person. The second thing is that at least it's been my experience that apps work best when they are single purpose, very easy to use, and very clear. So each of the apps in our suite does one thing and only one thing. And then if you hit the button for that app, you know what it is you're hitting the button for.
Got it. Okay. So I think we have some video of how the We Consent app works to give people a better idea of what we're talking about.
Say the name of the person with whom you want to have sexual relations.
Derek.
Partner, say your name.
Derek.
Love to have fun at the end. Although as sultry sounding as the lady's voice is on the app, one could see, especially in the context of that video, I think, where they're standing outdoors and it takes a while to get everything configured properly for the video to capture both people involved, it kind of grinds things to a halt. And maybe that's not a bad thing. What's your take on that, Michael?
Well, I'm going to give you two perspectives on it. One, it's a good thing because, the main purpose is the running of the app, but the evoking of a conversation about what it is that the two people are about to do. So mm-hmm. if you need to have a discussion about whether or not or how to run the app, that all by itself is a prelude to a discussion about the sexual encounter that they're planning. The second rejoinder to that has to do with something that reflects my age. When I was their age, condom manufacturers had not yet figured out that they were supposed to put perforations in the wrappers. So we all had a very awkward 2 or 3 minutes while we had to deal with getting it unwrapped, et cetera. And if we could survive that 2 or 3 minute interlude, I think young people today can survive the 18 to 20 seconds that this takes.
So this is so interesting on any number of levels and has, as I mentioned, drawn a lot of fire your way from folks who think that, gee, as creative as this isn't how we should be addressing sexual assault. It's certainly not going to solve the problem. That doesn't tend to make me have a negative opinion of it, the notion that there are other things you can do to solve sexual assault. It certainly seems like this is a useful tool. It could be a way to start a dialogue between people, between peers, between administrators and students that might not otherwise happen. You're not going to get a whole lot of criticism from me. We'll see what Kathy and Sarah think about this, because I think that, as many ways as we can tackle a problem is a good thing. But one thing that comes up over and over again in the criticism that you've received since the app's launched is the notion that consent is not a one-time thing, that it has to be continuous and it could be withheld at any time during the proceedings and turn what was a consensual encounter into a non-consensual one. And that the app doesn't really take that into account. Go ahead.
To which my normal reply is, if you only look at one app, you're absolutely right. But that's why there's mm-hmm. two apps. And the people that talk about this tend to want to downplay the fact that there's another app. Mm-hmm. It is also highly likely that the Yes app is going on one party's phone and the No app may be on the other party's phone. The reality is, if you want to say no, and if there's no physical coercion involved. I mean, because obviously everything is different if you're being threatened with a baseball bat. Mm-hmm. But if there's no physical coercion involved and you want to say no, you want to stop. And if you want to stop, you are going to do such things as get up. Reaching for your phone is not that unusual. Mm-hmm. Deciding that you have the ability, courtesy of the What About No app, to summon a policeman, I mean, that's fairly powerful. Mm-hmm. It's a virtual policeman. It's not a real policeman. No one's going to come knocking on the door. But nonetheless, policeman is there on your phone and can be summoned in half a second. Mm-hmm. You know, when people say consent is continuous, of course it is. And if you withdraw it, you withdraw it. But what they're leaving out is that we are in a context where the standard has become or is shifting to only yes means yes. And in that standard, how is it that you demonstrate that both people actually consented? Leaving things that he said, she said is not working. And no one has yet come up with a better way.
Yes, the only way to document in a video form that consent was ongoing would be to have the phone make a sex tape, which I don't think anybody would want to have happen for this purpose. Maybe for other purposes, but not for this purpose. So that is definitely a problem in your no app response might be a good one, because the only other alternative is to document the entire proceedings, and I don't think that's going to work for anybody. One reason why that wouldn't work for anybody, and one other potential problem with having all this video recorded, is you're very quick to emphasize the security and the encryption that's put on videos, but particularly, I mean, in the wake of last week's show's Ashley Madison discussions and you know, whatever the hack of the week might be, it seems to be trivially easy to get at protected information and make it public, even when it's information that was never supposed to get that way. Do you want to talk about the steps that you're taking to make sure that could not happen?
The only way you could make it happen would be to steal the offline servers. So, yes, information is picked up and transmitted via the cloud, but we sweep it every 5 to 10 minutes, and it's no longer available online. So, yeah, if you went in and stole the hard drives, you could get it. But I'm relying on the idea that both Amazon and Google, whose offline services we use, have fairly decent physical security to keep from walking in and stealing their physical equipment. If you try to get it online, both of those services trigger a large number of alerts to the people whose data that it is and don't deliver it for 5 or 6 hours. So you could make the request as a hacker. It still is going to take 5 or 6 hours, at which point we're going to know and put a stop to it. So shy of stealing the physical drives, the only data that's really available is 5 or 10 minutes worth. And yes, somebody, I suppose, could go in and steal that. I can't imagine, with everything else that's out there to be stolen, that finding two people's names who merely say yes is really great data, but you never know.
Right. So those recordings that are made by all the apps, they are not accessible to the users at all, whether you're using the Yes app or the No app. Is that right?
They are not available to the user unless the user has gone to a judge and obtained a subpoena.
Got it. Sarah, what do you think about the whole notion of video app consent?
I'm actually quite skeptical. I think there are a couple articles that in the show notes about this concept of kind of ongoing consent, and that really resonated to me, because it feels like this app would be more useful for proving yes than it would for actually somebody proving no. Just because you might, you know, you could, it just seems so easy to imagine the situation where they do the initial yes videos and then things, you know, transition and, you know, one of them changes their mind and they don't have a video record of that, but they have the yes video, and that can be used against the person in a really negative way. To me, that seems like more of a higher possibility.
Sarah, yeah. I have to interrupt and ask you, why is it that you think that they would not run the No app? I mean, it's not like they want to continue doing whatever it is they're physically doing with one another. The person has made a decision to stop. Why would he or she go reaching for the phone, which is going to be within 2 or 3 feet? We are talking about college people. The stats say 7% of them even sleep with it in their hand. 14% sleep with it under their pillow. 83% never let it shut off except when it reboots. Yes, if it was me and it was someone my age where I would have to go down to the kitchen to go get the phone, that's a completely different issue. But college kids have a phone within 2 feet.
Sorry, but if it's the case that they can reach for their phone and make the video, it seems like, and the person is going to let them stop and get out of it, then that would be just as easy as that person saying no. All they have to say is, hey, I'm not comfortable with it anymore, and it's over, and they don't need any sort of evidence. So it seems like
it's hard to imagine. It's not about evidence. It's not about evidence. It is about changing the way people have discussions. And you may think that both parties are rational and calm and doing things the right way. And it would be great if that was the case 99% of the time. I don't think it is. And sometimes you need an extra tool. You need an extra prop in order to get the idea across. If the one party is saying, I bought you dinner, you owe me. I'm not going to take you home. You owe me. It's really cold outside. You don't want to have to walk home. You owe me. This gives them another tool to play back, to add into, if you like, the psychological combat that may ensue once somebody decides to change their mind. And to just assert that everybody's going to yield when somebody says no, it's great. It would be marvelous, but it's naive.
No, I am definitely not saying that everyone's going to yield, but I'm going to say that the people who are going to let the woman go find the phone, take it out and say, you know, make her no video, are the same people that are going to stop when you say no. I guess I'm having a hard time kind of seeing when it's going to come up.
I have a hard time accepting that premise. I'm sorry. That's just not been my observation or understanding of the college students today. You are immediately jumping from bad behavior to good behavior, and I don't think that's the way this works.
So have you
Go ahead, Kathy.
Have you actually tested this? Is there any user testing? I mean, you're making some assumptions that you've got some data to suggest are reasonable starting assumptions. But what is the user testing of relationships where encounters have been successful, either in terms of yes and yes or yes and no, where the parties are of accord? Is there any usability testing when it has turned into a he said, she said, where a consent was withdrawn and it was not respected? And have you seen this app actually being used in those environments? It feels like there's two sides of what you're saying it would be useful for, one of which initially was an evidentiary one where it can help document that consent had been withdrawn. And I think there might be some concerns there, both in terms of is it actually usable evidence of that, given the timing of can we assume from whatever no gets recorded that it was an effective no that had been communicated. And also whether, as Sarah points out, whether it's realistic
to interrupt you for a moment.
Okay.
The no, you know, is recorded because when you communicate the no, you are making a video of the other person watching the no.
Okay.
It would be very hard for that person to indicate that they did not get it because you have a video of them watching the no.
Okay. I think Sarah's concern – okay, that's interesting that there's the two people and you would do it. But Sarah's concern is also, are people really keeping their devices this close in this type of situation on a reliable enough basis for this community? Do we have actual data to suggest that, yes, in fact, there is, and that people will have these types of encounters with these sorts of devices nearby where they can be relied on to be a tool for this encounter? We are making presumptions, and I hear your data that they may not be generationally, they may be somewhat plausible assumptions, but is there any data to suggest that as these relationships are truly unfolding, that that these devices are being used?
To which my reply is, as the usage occurs, the data will get generated. This is a major social change. We are asking people to go from a standard of no means no to only yes means yes. The important thing in all of this is the affirmative consent standard demands that the young people engage in a discussion first. The purpose of these apps is as a prop and as a tool to evoke those discussions. The legal stuff, the evidence stuff, is all secondary. That is not the main purpose at all. If it needs to be used for that, fine. But that is not what the apps are about. The apps are about tools to change the context, to evoke or provoke discussion. And if two people have a discussion about whether or not to run the app and decide not to run the app, by me, that's a major success. It has nothing to do with needing the app to be run. It has everything to do with getting them to talk to each other first before they do whatever it is they're going to do.
Yeah, I think that goes along with the point that's made in the NPR article and piece that included discussion of weak consent and various other things that college campuses are doing to try and address this problem on campus, and the bringing in the bystander training program that's discussed there. There's a little back and forth about giving some scenarios to people, and the example they give is that there's a girl who's really drunk and she's being taken home by a guy who's told you that he would like them to get together. What do you do? You know, what do you do to intervene? This looks like it could be a dangerous situation. And some folks jumped in and said, I'd try and accompany them home and make sure everything was okay. But the trainer said, you know, you really got to think more like a kid and think more about just sort of putting the brakes on to the situation. Maybe you just go over and ask the couple if they want to go for pizza. Maybe you back up against a light switch and accidentally on purpose flip it on. Anything that just sort of has a break in the action and makes people consider what they're doing. And I think that this app could, you know, definitely serve that purpose as well. I have a hard time thinking practically first that people... that a lot of young people would have it on their phones unless they were required to. And I know that you're making some overtures that might make that a reality, Michael, by talking to sports teams and their coaches and college administrators and trying to get it adopted on more of an institutional level. So that might be helpful. But I personally just am skeptical that young people would think, hey, you know, this is fun. I think I'll put this on my phone.
Well, Denise, I think okay, now we will switch to where there is a law thing, which is the impact of being falsely accused is devastating. Mm-hmm. And to suggest that there are not at least several million college males who are worried about that is also naive.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And
The cases
I'm the
that
mother
have
of a young man, so horrible. This is near and dear to my heart.
I mean, the cases that have occurred have been simply horrible. Mm-hmm. And to suggest that the male may not want this on their phone, then the male may want it on their phone not because it's fun, but because they think that by at least triggering the conversation, they have a much better idea what it is they're getting themselves into. And again, the purpose is much better served if the two parties just have the discussion about what they're going to do and never run the app. Mm-hmm. But you need the prop in order to cause the conversation to occur.
Yep, I get what you're saying. Sarah, do you have any final thoughts on this before we move on?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I guess I'm skeptical. I think... you know, if it's really just a tool to prompt the conversation, I think that is healthy and good. And obviously, the more talking they do, the better. But I'm uncomfortable with the evidentiary aspect of it. Like, I really think that could actually have negative implications. And so I worry about that aspect of it. But in terms of like prompting a discussion and that sort of thing, you know, it's hard to argue with that. So,
Kathy, the other aspect of this that fascinates me is this whole notion of, well, this is not a contract or not an enforceable civil contract in any way that the law would recognize. But the notion of having technology be the vehicle by which an agreement is set forth, I think is pretty new and interesting and is happening on all kinds of fronts. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
I mean, there's a temptation, I think, when I first read about this to say I could understand how the word icky got thrown around, where the idea that you would have technology intermediating a very, very primal human relationship. And is that really the path that we want humanity to develop around? And maybe there's some costs, even if this app is absolutely perfect for all intended purposes, is that a good thing? I'd actually rather have a more neutral view towards the technology, where it's kind of neutral itself. It's not necessarily a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I think what Michael's suggesting is it is a changing thing, and that change can be good and change can be bad. But I think there might be, as we sort of figure out how we want technology in general to start interacting with how we've understood life to unfold, it sort of, I think, needs to unfold a little bit organically. And the one thing I bristled at, I share Sarah's concerns about the app overall and the evidentiary issues, but the one thing which we just brushed on was the idea that it might be required. And I think when you start prescribing technology as a solution for human problems, especially when it's sort of reflexively, we know we have a problem, and I don't think any of us are disagreeing that there are issues with how these relationships are unfolding and the communication and the consent that's happening around them. But is just adding technology the right way to go down, or are we accidentally potentially creating more problems? And I think when I'm hearing language about it being required, I'm starting to react to it negatively, because I think people should have full range of discretion over the technology tools they choose to use or not use.
So can you speak to that, Michael? Can you tell us what success you've had, if any, of having this sort of more institutionally adopted?
Well, institutionally adopted does not necessarily mean required. Mm-hmm. We're in discussions with about 300 colleges and universities about having them make it available campus-wide or system-wide. But making available is not the same as requiring. The only people that we're aware of that have chosen to go the required route are some sports teams. Mm-hmm. And quite bluntly, given some of the press that has gone on around sports teams, I'm not sure that there's a problem with telling people who are on scholarship and are in effect getting paid to behave in a certain manner that there's one more requirement that they have to fulfill, when there's a history amongst that segment of the population for bad things to happen.
Yeah, I understand that argument. It's actually one that in other contexts I find rather troubling. I'm thinking in particular about social media policies for what scholarship athletes can do. And some of this is private university, but many of it's public university. And the idea, there's a lot of instances where athletes are essentially being forced to negotiate away their general First Amendment rights in exchange for their scholarship. And I find those troubling. So I would extend those concerns even to this environment, where I, you know, have it available as an option, fine. Maybe even we go down the social, the path of, is there enough social pressure where even if it's not technically obligatory, it becomes sort of de facto obligatory. I'd have to think that through. But when it's truly sort of an official condition, I think there's general First Amendment rights in terms of how people use their technology. And so when technology is forced down people's throats, I think that creates some very significant issues, no matter how well-intentioned that requirement actually is.
And Kathy, I'm going to reply to you with, just because they require that you install it on your phone does not mean that anyone's ever been required to use it.
Okay,
so
fair
again,
enough.
All that's being required is that you have prop. It's there to be talked about, which again is the main purpose of the apps. So the requirement that's been imposed by the schools that have imposed it on their sports teams is you must have this on your phone. The athlete knows it's on his or her phone. What they do after that remains their business. They are required to have the prop. you cannot buy a car in the United States that does not come with seatbelts.
I think
the law says you're supposed to use them, but there's nothing that's actually going to force you to.
I still think there's significant concerns towards the liberty interest of the student to be required to install any particular software on any particular device they choose to own. I can understand all the arguments for why we might think this is a good thing in this particular instance, but I think it's something that on a macro level we need to take a step back and think very seriously about before we start having that conversation about any sort of software or any sort of app.
Kathy, the technology person in me is going to say most colleges are going to some form of hybrid online learning, and the only way you can partake in the online part is to make use of the software suite that the college wished you to. So they already are faced with a requirement of having software that they must somehow access if they wish to get that portion of their education.
It doesn't obviate the concerns, though. It doesn't obviate any of the concerns. And in those contexts, the colleges could potentially offer school-provided equipment. In my day, we had computer labs. Maybe nobody wants to use that. But there are ways of dealing or open technologies where if it's web browser-based, people tend to have web browsers. There's not really as forced a requirement to be able to interact with any particular content driving the particular device that the person owns. So the fact that – and I wouldn't take too much out of the fact that we may see people already cruising past these concerns as evidence that the concerns aren't valid. It's sort of more reason for alarm to suggest that maybe we need to take a step back and look at all the instances where people are requiring students to have specific software on specific devices. I think that's problematic for the general liberty interest that implicates.
Sure, and you could see that happening in any number of contexts. Just sticking with sports teams for a moment, maybe there's an app that's required to analyze strategies or plays or what have you that's a tool that the whole team is using and everyone's required to have. But maybe it also has some sort of nefarious information gathering technology that the students don't have any control over, and that would be a concern. I could definitely see that, you know, in any number. You have to be careful if you're going to be an academic institution requiring students to use particular programs or technologies that they are completely above board with how they're handling information and data and everything else. But I don't know that I'm ready to say that there can't be a requirement. You know, if you're taking a course, you need to access a particular thing, you have to use a particular tool. I think that's up to the school and the professor and the students. If they don't like it, can get their education probably somewhere else. But I can understand it's a concern. Maybe it's a concern that should be put on the institution itself to make sure that, you know, to the extent it needs to incorporate technology into students' lives, that they're making darn sure that technology is doing no harm. Does that work for you?
I think that's very important. I mean, I'm thinking through the issues somewhat preliminarily, but I'm less affronted by something which says point your web browser to here and we're going to just deliver you web content, because in theory, we're not really affecting the way, I mean, I'm presuming this is true in any specific instance. It's sometimes not true when we're forcing down ActiveX controls or maybe Java software, where we might actually be forcing more software onto a computer via the web. So just because we're pointing web browser doesn't necessarily mean it's neutral, but I think it's more likely to have open technologies, things that are neutral, where anything fancy in particular to the educational experience is happening on the server side, the institution servers, where if there's problems with that, it's not affecting people's own equipment, the students' own equipment, and they're not being forced to accidentally, particularly with phones, it's problematic, where the privacy policies say, yes, we will be touching your microphone and your hard drive and your contacts and this, that, and the other thing, and students don't have control over that. So the less of an imposition the software makes on any particular device, I think the better.
All right. Well, we have another sort of crime and justice related story, a new decision from the Ninth Circuit overturning some verdicts under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that we're going to get to in a second. We're going to get to another of Michael's apps, this one aimed at a different social problem and a different demographic in just a moment. But before we get to either of those, we're going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Braintree. Braintree is code for easy online payments. If you're a mobile app developer, you've got to check out Braintree. Braintree is the payment solution used by companies like Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and Munchery. Braintree scaled with these companies from early stage startups to the successful companies they are today. So Braintree can scale with your business too. Braintree has made the payment experiences in these apps seamless and magical. And now you can add a similar experience to your very own app. With excellent customer service and simple integration, Braintree gets you ready to receive payments quickly. And Braintree's continuous support plus fast payouts means you'll be prepared as your company grows from your first dollar to your billionth. Braintree is helping solve the problem of mobile cart abandonment by offering a best-in-class mobile checkout experience. You've got to check it out for yourself. Braintree gives you a full stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want. You can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and much more, all with a single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. We'll also go ahead and put our first MCLE passphrase into the show, and I think it'll be, there's an app for that, based on much of what our discussion is today. We are going to get back into talking about the No app, a different kind of No app than the one we've been discussing in just a moment here, but we had a new decision just out from the Ninth Circuit overturning some Computer Fraud and Abuse Act verdicts. Kathy, can you tell us what went on there? It looks like it was a bad jury instruction.
Fraud and Abuse Act is a very complicated statute. It was something important to recognize is it was passed in 1984 in response to Ronald Reagan seeing war games and saying, people can hack our systems like that. We should have a law, right? And so we got the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which has then been subsequently amended intermittently over various years up till now. And it sort of left us with a very complicated statutory mess that different circuits are trying to untangle and figure out what they mean. And in particular, they stumbled on the section, I don't have that in front of me right now, but it talks about unauthorized access, where in theory the liability is triggering over whether somebody interacted with a computer system that they did so without the authorization to do that. But in this case, they were looking at scenarios where what the people actually did with the data they weren't supposed to use, where people were making queries to databases that they had no official right to play with, but they did have authorization, or at least potentially, in terms of accessing the database for official reasons. So the question is, when you parsed out the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, would that make a crime where you had authorization to look at the database, but you didn't have authorization to do what you did with the database? And under Ninth Circuit precedent for the case called U.S. versus, I think it's pronounced Nosal, I may be wrong on that, N-O-S-A-L. Mm-hmm. Under that one, it said no, that the liability hinged on whether you were able to access the system with authorization or not. And you can't look at the specific use as the thing itself that the liability is contingent on. And so the question here is that the jury instruction didn't reflect that Ninth Circuit interpretation of what that clause actually meant. And so that's why they had to unwind it. But one of the interesting things here is there's also various states, I believe, have their own, more or less, their own little versions of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that are trying to do similar policy things of punishing people doing things with computers that it turns out we don't like them doing with their computers. And California has its own, but it's written somewhat differently. And so it looks like from this decision that there wasn't the same concern about the jury instruction with respect to the California one, because its statutory provision was written differently. And the way it was written didn't necessarily have this unauthorized access versus use dichotomy that the CFAA actually has.
All right. So we had convictions here. They got overturned. Orrin Kerr, who wrote this up for the Washington Post, is a bit mystified that just because the Ninth Circuit has a different interpretation of what the statute means, the jury instruction actually tracked the statute pretty closely. And he finds it strange that you could have a jury instruction that basically mirrored what a law said and still have it be plain error sufficient to support reversing a trial court's decision. So if you want more on that, go ahead and read Professor Kerr's take on that in the Washington Post. That and everything else we're discussing today is available in our discussion points at TagPacker. You can find the user This Week in Law there. And all our discussion points will be laid out for you in beautiful living color. Sarah, any thoughts on this Ninth Circuit decision?
Not really. I don't know much about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I guess I know enough to know that it is, it's written so broadly that it can encompass things that seem kind of crazy, like making a Facebook account, for example, for somebody else, technically, or at least can be interpreted to be a violation of it. So I guess, I'm happy seeing anything that kind of narrows it. It was really fascinating, Kathy. I didn't realize that little anecdote about how it came into being about Reagan and watching war games. That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's long forgotten, and it was. There's been a lot of amendments to the statute since then. The big problem now is we have the policy behind it has gotten so muddled and buried as we've sought to sort of use the statute to solve all sorts of problems in one statutory form. And now it's not doing any of them very well. And as you point out, it has the potential to have a lot of collateral damage to very reasonable behaviors. The point I was emphasizing earlier about, I think it's really important that people be able to use particularly their own technology, but technology in reasonable ways. And this tends to be very chilling towards very reasonable uses of technology, where I'm not going to quibble with the policy argument that it's bad if people hack our nuclear arsenal and start playing with it. I think that might be a problem, and that's something we might want to address with some sort of law. But we now have a statute that, as you said, could have potentially apply, although in the case you're referring to, it did not apply to people making false Facebook accounts. And that's a very different behavior with their very different intent and very different outcome than what we were originally going for. But that these amendments have now brought in the statute where it can catch all sorts of things. But the problem is it's catching benign or even potentially socially good behaviors like security research, in as much as it's potentially not necessarily even stopping an offshore nuclear hacker who's not subject to U.S. law anyway. So
right. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please do, Michael.
So, Kathy, what would this do in the Aaron Schwartz case where he was authorized to access from Harvard? He was not authorized to access from MIT.
I am not entirely sure I would agree with that. He had access to the MIT's network. MIT's network was open, and so he went on this open network and accessed it that way.
But I'm just referring particularly to JSTOR, where he had passwords from Harvard that he was authorized with, but he had no MIT passwords for JSTOR.
Well, one of the reasons why, I mean, we could probably quibble a little bit about the factual basis, that it shows why this law may be problematic, because if we're looking for this gotcha, where what was the element that all of a sudden could trigger liability around it? He was allowed to have he was allowed to be on the network he was on, and he was allowed to access the stuff that he accessed. So how is it reasonable to have a law that can all of a sudden take ingredients from one column and ingredients from another column and all of a sudden make a law that's now targeted with liability, something that individually wasn't wrong. I think a lot of people are sort of looking at this on a more normative basis. Some people do not like what he was doing in terms of they don't see any social value. I would disagree. I think there's a lot of people who do see social value with the idea of freeing knowledge and making it available. But some people were very offended by that. And I think they've looked around for, if it feels wrong, how can we prosecute it? And they looked around and found a very conveniently broad law that they could parse out as however was convenient to sort of backing up that sense of wrongness and applying it to him. And then we also have problems with the law where even if it were legitimate to parse out the law to target this behavior, then we also look at what's the consequences of it. And they're extremely steep sentences, felony convictions, long sentences that also are, even if you thought there was a social harm to what he was doing, is this a reasonable penalty for whatever harm that was potentially triggering? That case is extraordinarily tragic, but puts into focus a lot of the significant problems that we have with the CFAA.
Michael, this might be a weird transition, but since we're talking about the CFAA and how there have been cases where falsifying a social media account has been prosecuted as a violation of that act, I'm wondering, getting back to the apps that you're developing and putting out there, what sort of steps are in place, if any, that would prevent the apps from being a tool for impersonation? In other words, one or the other of the parties involved could be made out to be giving consent when that wasn't actually the case, or the app could be, you know, could it be put on someone's phone without verifying the identity of whose phone it was on? Are you paying attention to those kinds of issues?
We are. I mean, we spent 3 months going through this with all kinds of lawyers to make sure we had all that stuff sort of under wraps. Mm-hmm. But I will point out to you, the apps record video. Mm-hmm. So to argue that the person who's being videoed is not the person who's being videoed would be a very strange argument.
Right.
It doesn't mean that somebody who is intoxicated could not be pretending to be sober. That's certainly the case. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that there might not be physical coercion such that we can't, that you see offline. I mean, maybe there's a gun in someone's back. We don't know. But mm-hmm. in those instances, it's no different than what would happen in the absence of the apps. We still are down to he said, she said, with physical coercion being involved. And right. then you get the weird things like Bill Cosby, who seems to believe that people wanted things despite the fact that he gave them drugs before they did whatever they did. Apps aren't going to help in those situations.
Okay, well, let's talk about whether one of your apps can help with bullying. So this one is not aimed at the college or young adult set, but at a younger crowd involving children. I think that may be the first time we've used our kids' bumper since it was created by our intern, Sando. That's his little daughter in the picture there. Her name is Daenerys, and she's a cutie pie. Okay, so hopefully Daenerys will never find herself subject to anyone at school who's anything but wonderful and nice and polite to her. Unfortunately, that's not the lot of every child out there. And you've sort of taken your no app technology, Michael, and redesigned it, repackaged it a bit to address the bullying problem. Can you tell us how that would play out?
Well, okay. I think we need to give the people that are watching some statistics because they're fairly shocking.
Okay.
So you've got to understand that 25 to 33% of all kids that go through K-12 will report that they have felt bullied at one time or another. over 70% of them will then go on and report that there were bystanders who stood by and did nothing. And almost all of the activity that's gone on in the anti-bullying front to date before this app came along was either about educating kids in the school about why bullying is bad, or was trying to educate and give tools to bystanders to stand up and do things. And then we get to the most troubling statistic of all, which is the people that have felt bullied report that 85% of the time the school district did nothing. The bystanders are being encouraged to report things to the schools, but the vast majority of the time, the people who perceive themselves to be victims do not feel the school has done anything to protect them. In light of all of that, we said an app that gives the victim a sense of empowerment and gives the victim's parents a sense of empowerment can be very changing to the context. So the No app is a version, again, of the other app that says no. But the difference this time is when your kid hits the No app, the parents are instantly notified, both email and SMS, of the geolocation of the phone. Now, I'll point out that means for something other than just bullies. If there's been a perp, if there's been a stranger, if your kid has been led astray, and then the kid hits the button, the parents now have some way of knowing where the kid's phone at least is. If the phone is not where the kid is, by the time the parent gets there, that's different. But at least they were told where the phone was when the button got hit. The other thing that the app does is it allows the victim to record, again, the person bothering them watching a no message. First time that you do it to a bully, the bully may react with shock. The bully may ignore it. The bully may do something to the phone. Mm-hmm. If the bully did something to the phone, every police department that we've talked to said, you just crossed a magic line. And the magic line is the police are very good at dealing with property crime. Mm-hmm. They're not that good at dealing with psychological crime. They're not very good at dealing with the word of one kid against another. But the minute the bully does something to that telephone, that's a property crime. And it's a property crime where the phone is creating its own evidence. It's getting uplifted to the cloud. The police are very good at dealing with that one. And once that happens, the entire dialogue changes because suddenly the bully is no longer the one with the leverage. Now the kid whose phone was taken or broken, the parents of a kid whose phone was taken or broken, and the police have a lot more to say about what's going to happen than the bully does.
All right. So this is just launched this month, I believe, just in the last week
Correct.
Or so?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. I think it adds something to your other No app. It adds the panic button function that you were discussing. Can that be tweaked so that it's... if it's more appropriate to have the principal or a teacher notified, can they be set as the contact person?
Right now we have it set with 2 emails and 2 SMSs, and the parent is free to put whatever they want there. Mm-hmm. We have told the schools and the school departments that we're talking to that if they want to deploy it on a school-wide or a school district-wide basis, that we're happy to add a fifth field so that some contact address or number at the school is notified as well. That's easily added if somebody wants it.
Right. Like your other apps, I think this is a great way to grind things to a halt and get a conversation going that might not otherwise happen. I would imagine that we might see a lot of smashed phones. And as you said, that could lead to more effective or direct means of punishments. But
even the punishment, Denise.
Yeah.
It's also the dialogue again.
Yeah.
Most of the time when the schools are not getting involved, it's because they don't want to get involved in something that's a he said, he should said, she said. Mm-hmm. The phone app creates evidence. The smashed phone, if there is one, is evidence. The fact is that while the phone's getting smashed, it's recording who's smashing it. So that's further evidence. Once there's a record, the school departments are much better at actually doing something when they have real evidence. This is the one time where the discussion we had before about the nature of evidence actually does make a big difference in this case, because the people that the parents think are going to be the first line of defense have not been acting in very many cases. And the reason that they've not been acting is that the school departments are afraid to do so in the absence of evidence. So by giving them evidence, we are also empowering the school department to do what it would might otherwise want to do, which is intervene.
Right. And just psychologically, I think once, you know, the playing of that no message to someone who's bullying you, the first time it happens, it's bound to just completely take them by surprise and maybe make them do a double take and go, whoa, you know, if this, I've been going forward on the premise that this was all happening clandestinely and no one would ever know that we've been bullying this poor child. And now there's some accountability brought into it. That wasn't otherwise there, and that could be effective. Sarah, what do you think of this one?
I mean, I hate to say it, I'm skeptical again. I guess I'm less. Mm-hmm. I'm having a hard time seeing how it would be harmful, though, unlike the other one. So, but
well, let me jump in and supply that one for you, because I, of course, ran this by my 11-year-old, and his thought was, first of all, it needs to have a panic button, which it does have, but he wished that you didn't have to launch the app to get to the panic button. If there were some way that you could just sort of touch the power button on your phone, or, you know, I know that's harder to pull off from an app development standpoint, but he felt like launching the app was a step too far to, if you're actually in some dire situation where you're about to get pounded, to actually get your phone out and launch an app might be difficult. But his other comment was, well, I could see how this could be turned on someone and used to frame someone as a bully. And I asked him to try and play that out. And he said, well, just, you know, again, since you launched the app and someone's notified that there's a situation going on, that immediately casts suspicion on what's happening. And maybe this is being used aggressively. Now, I know that's not a good reason to say it's not a good app and not serving a good purpose, but certainly people have, and kids in particular too, will show their ability to use technology in creative ways. And that's one thing that could happen, don't you think, Michael?
Well, now I'm going to put the burden back on his parent. Mm-hmm. You're getting a notification. In theory, the way we've seen this play out so far, it works as follows. You have a discussion with your child when you put the app on his or her phone the first time. A kid is a kid. Sometime in the next 48 hours, that app is going to get run, whether anyone is bothering him or her or not. Mm-hmm. And guess what? You're notified. This gives you the opportunity for yet another discussion. Now, sometime in the next 3 or 4 days or a week, he's going to do it again, probably to a friend or a sibling. And this gives yet another opportunity for a discussion. Now, my understanding of pedagogy as a teacher is 3 times tends to be a magic number. So at least you've had 3 preliminary discussions with your child about the importance of this app's use. If your child starts using the app aggressively to say everyone is bullying him or her, you need having a very different kind of discussions with your child. Mm-hmm. Remember, you're going to be the one who gets notified. It's unlikely, if there's a whole series of these, that some third party is going to say, gee, these videos have great evidentiary value, other than to say your child might need some help. There's a big difference between 1 or 2 directed at a particular bully or a perp or a stranger and an entire series directed at all kinds of people because your child feels that this has somehow empowered him or her to accuse people of being bullies.
Right. Hey, Kathy, I'm curious what you think about this app in particular and about technology and bullying on the larger sense. On the one hand, it can facilitate bullying in various ways. The app we're talking about here is about physical confrontations person to person, but technology certainly has whole other facets by which people can get bullied. But it also has other facets, you know, app or no app, by which situations which would otherwise have been carried out behind closed doors or not monitored or not made public can be captured. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that whole dynamic.
My initial reaction is one that's a little more sociological, which is, have we defined, like, bullying is a very broad term. Are we even in the realm where we're talking about physical bullying, or are we talking about other forms of bullying? There's a lot of psychological bullying that goes on among kids, which I don't have data, but maybe Michael does. I'm wondering if that's the bigger portion of the bullying data, or is the bullying data that he's citing relating to physical bullying?
Most of it is psychological.
So that being the case, I feel like there still might be a definitional problem. As far as the physical bullying, I would have the concern that wielding the phone as a defense, not only is the phone going to get smashed, but the kid is likely to get smashed. So this may not be a good idea of something to arm your kid with, because it might have unfortunate physical results in the attempt of providing a defense. But if we're talking about psychological bullying, I think we've got a very complex issue that schools are not necessarily dealing well with. I think mostly because as a society, we're not entirely sure how we want to deal with it. I think there's something overall that's good about the recognition of a lot of psychological pressure on kids that used to happen without anybody stopping. It was just kids are being kids, and nobody ever really looked twice at it. And there's something to be said for, we've evolved as a society and we can recognize that, no, this actually can have a really harmful and lasting effect on kids potentially. And maybe this is something we should try to discourage as part of how we raise kids to be decent adults. But I sometimes wonder if if we have too much of a knee-jerk overreaction to some of it, and we lose a lot of nuance, and sometimes schools are not good at the nuance, and sometimes the expectation of school fix it, that might not necessarily be an appropriate role for the school to take. Or if it did try to fix it, it would come at the expense of some other important things. I mean, we do see, and this is similar to the issue I raised before, of schools increasingly overstepping their governing school hours to now trying to govern student behavior beyond the schoolyard, things that they do off campus, things that they do off campus with social media. Now the schools want to police. And I think we may have asked for this in a way, and I think it's something we should give back, because I think there's some significant harm to education and the autonomy of students, even students who are minors, in their ability to express themselves and grow up. And so again, I think my skepticism is this a problem that we understand well enough where just add technology is going to be an effective solution, or it might even exacerbate some of the general problems we're seeing about how we deal with bullying in general?
Well, I don't know that Michael would say that this is the solution to the problem, right? It's a way of addressing
Again, it's a tool. And I'm hearing Kathy express general skepticism about employing technology in the absence of well-said things, but that's not the world we live in. We try things. They work. They don't work. We learn from how people interact with them. And to argue that we have to wait for lots of data to see what happens, it doesn't work in the drug world. I don't know why it would work in this part of the world either. Technology moves very quickly. These are big societal issues. To suggest that we should not be attempting tools that can make a major difference because we haven't fully studied them, I think is just quite foolish.
I'm actually sort of intrigued by the idea about the experiment of adding technology to certain problems. I think my concern is that the problem itself is poorly defined, and this isn't really addressed to the app itself. This is addressed more to some frustrations about how we as a society are trying to deal with bullying as a social problem among children, and my frustrations are more there. I think those problems are significant enough that's why I sort of don't tend to think that the technology is going to be tailored enough to effectively solve them. But I am somewhat intrigued about if you add technology, which we're doing anyway by default because technology is becoming more ubiquitous in our lives, what is the effect? But then we also sort of run into the problems of kids as guinea pigs, and what if, you know, them doing this does change child behavior in a way that maybe is a bad thing, or in an individual instance, what if it causes the bully to actually kick the crap out of them? So there are some concerns that way. But actually, from that standpoint, I'm sort of, you know, what is the role that technology have? And I think it can be exciting to find out. But I don't think that's necessarily the problem that I'm getting stuck on or that society is getting stuck on. I think it's something bigger.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, Kathy. I certainly like the notion of, you know, you put it out there, if it helps some kids, that's a good thing. If it winds up having consequences that people didn't foresee, then you course correct and try and cope with that. In IRC, there have been a couple of comments that, you know, as soon as the app is first used, the bullies get smarter, right? They know you take away the person's phone, or you put their hands behind their back, or whatever, you make it so that it's just not a factor anymore. And maybe that is a problem, but it doesn't mean that it's not, that it might not help in certain circumstances. Any thoughts along those lines, Michael?
Well, I will point out that, again, most of the statistics actually indicate that most bullies are themselves suffering from insecurity complexes that they're overcompensating for. And the comments that you're seeing in the IRC chat may be right, mm-hmm. but it may also be that some vast number of the bullies are instead going to react with fear.
Mm-hmm. Well, one could only hope. Sarah, any final thoughts on this?
No, I mean, I think I agree with Kathy that I think you're onto something, Kathy, about this kind of, are we over-defining the problem or so broadly defining it? You know, you hear so much about bullying now, and I guess one of the things that's been on my reading list for a long time, and I haven't gotten to it yet, is Emily Bazelon's book about bullying. But I've heard her speak about it, and I think that you know, one of her arguments there is that by defining bullying so broadly, we're almost trivializing it in a way that is actually counterproductive for the really serious cases of bullying which are going on. And so I guess my reaction, I'm also I guess I'm biased because I'm currently reading the book Free Range Kids, and it's about how paranoid we are now about you know, our kids getting kidnapped, or, you know, all of these different things. And so my kind of gut reaction to this was, you know, it's another thing to be fearful of. It's another panic button where it feels to me like we're just a society that just is waiting for another thing to worry about. But on the other hand, I guess, you know, unlike with the consent app, I don't feel like it could be harmful. So it's, to me, it's a fine experiment, and if it helps people, then obviously that's a good thing. I don't really see a downside, I guess. It's just not something that I would probably choose for my child, but.
We're getting some inquiries from our audience, Michael, about where the No app is available and the other apps we've discussed today.
Okay, so the No app is available. The easiest way, because Apple has made things difficult, is to just go to the-no-app.com and click on the link, which will bring you to the right place in the App Store. For whatever reason, if you search for it by name in the App Store, you have to leave out the hyphens or it does not come up. Thank you, Apple. if you are a group or a school district, you send me an email either from the website or directly, and we can do the group things for you. And then for the We Consent suite of apps, you must go through protect=respect.com because Apple banned them from the App Store. So the only way that you can get them is by getting them directly from us. But it's not a problem. It's just one extra click. When you join ICE, which is the Institute for the Study of Coherence and Emergence, as a student member, you get the apps. You get your own store that has the apps in them. It's one extra step, but it's all of about an extra 60 or 75 seconds.
All right. Thanks for that. We're getting lots of people in IRC are very interested in the bullying issue, are giving us all kinds of good comments and insights. One is, of course, bullying is not limited to the school environment. Yes, of course, it's not. Can happen anywhere and with all our kids and so many after school and extracurricular activities, it can really honestly happen during any aspect of their life. So as much trouble as we might have defining what is bullying and what's not, certainly kids know when they feel intimidated and hurt. So as parents, it's something that's much on our minds and always interested in creative solutions to the problem. Let's move on to a different aspect of the law, copyright.
Something easy, okay.
Yeah. Following up on last week's discussions of Ashley Madison and the fallout of the data leaks there, the EFF has an interesting piece critiquing the fact that Ashley Madison has been sending DMCA takedown notices to various sites that have said that they've got the leaked data available and making sort of broad sweeping statements about how all of the Ashley Madison data is the intellectual property of Ashley Madison. EFF points out how that's very problematic, that most of the reported types of data that have been leaked, names, addresses, email addresses, that kind of thing, wouldn't be subject to copyright protection at all. And to the extent that some of the things leaked could be subject to copyright protection. For example, descriptions of that are included in people's profiles, anything that might involve a higher degree of creativity, that those might be copyrighted to the users, but not necessarily Ashley Madison, unless a whole bunch of complicated assignment procedures had taken place, which EFF strongly doubts has happened. So the whole point here is the DMCA, while everyone wants to see, you know, the data controlled, or many do anyway, that the DMCA is not the vehicle that Ashley Madison should be using to try and get it back under wraps. Do you agree, Kathy?
Oh, absolutely. I think what EFF is pointing out is a general problem with the DMCA becoming a stock how to censor content on the internet tool that people are using willy-nilly without checking whether they actually have any sort of valid copyright interest to justify them wielding it. I think it's the DMCA is this very strange thing. In some ways, it's good because it's created a framework by which internet intermediaries can exist. If they toe the line and dot enough I's, they can kind of be okay. And in that sense, it's a good thing because it's better that they can be okay and be in business than not. But I think it's not necessarily the best thought out statute. It's not very well balanced even under the best of circumstances. And particularly because 512F, which is the bit about it that gives teeth to the idea that if you send an abusive takedown notice, you're in trouble, is A, probably underpowered, and B, not being particularly well enforced by courts. There's really no deterrent for anybody to send a DMCA notice to an internet intermediary, and it's a hard call for an intermediary to say to try to turn one down. Arguably they can if it's on the face not valid, but they put themselves potentially in the line of fire if they try to make that decision and somebody takes issue with the quality of that decision.
Right. They can be on the hook for the costs and fees of the other side if they're sending these out without adequate justification.
And under 512F, there should be a penalty to somebody who's sending a DMCA notice that they have no business under the statute to send out. This is not something that's been well enforced. There is a case pending in the Ninth Circuit, Lenz v. Universal, which is challenging. This was the Dancing Baby case where a woman filmed her then toddler, now apparently 10 years old kid, dancing with reckless joy as a toddler would to some music in the background that happened to have been Prince music. She uploaded that video. It, you know, had a couple hundred hits, if that, from family members looking at this cute kid. And then it got a takedown notice from Universal because, heaven forbid, they had some Prince music in the background. And whereas her use was, she wasn't affecting the market for Prince's music. She wasn't having any effect on any of his copyright interest other than it was just there. Fair use pretty clearly applies to this, but nonetheless, Universal went ahead and took it and forced it to be taken down. And arguably 512F says you have to at least stop and think about whether fair use might actually apply before you send a takedown. And there's an open question of whether they did, since it's not like it was a clear copy of an exact copy of a Prince song. It was an application where this music showed up in the background. They didn't seem to do that analysis. They sent the takedown notice anyway. And in theory, that's wrong. But we are not seeing the teeth being applied to Universal doing that. And we're not seeing any teeth being applied to people sending dubious takedown notices, either because they don't own the copyright or because it isn't copyrightable in the first place. There's all sorts of defects that are showing up. It generally is, if people do not like content, they send a takedown notice because it kind of puts a gun to the intermediary's head to say, you want to risk the liability if you're wrong on this call? And that's a hard business call for intermediaries to make. Also, particularly given the volume of takedown notices some of these intermediaries get.
Right. Hey, Sarah, if you received a takedown notice from Ashley Madison under the DMCA, what do you think you'd do?
Well, let's hope some of that data isn't up on Creative Commons website.
Yeah, exactly. With a Creative Commons license attached.
Right, exactly. No, I mean, I think Mitch's EFF post is exactly right, that there's probably no copyright to speak of. And if there is any, it's not owned by the company that owns Ashley Madison. So it seems like an obvious case where the DMCA is just being used as a censorship tool. And I completely agree with Kathy's assessment that, you know, this is really, the DMCA really, all of the incentives for intermediaries is for taking down. And there's really no one has a good economic incentive, at least, to actually go after people that are, well, to, first of all, to fight takedowns, and then also to actually enforce 512F. The one tool, I guess, that we have is, you know, the bad publicity that comes up sometimes. I mean, every once in a while you hear about these crazy takedowns, and it, you know, it gets some news, at least in our world. I don't know how much of a deterrent effect that actually has, but it's something. But it almost seems like the only tool that we have at this point.
And it probably wouldn't even apply here, because I think the general sense is, gosh, this data should not be anywhere. So I think people, the hegemonic view is probably get rid of this stuff by whatever means we can possibly get rid of it, but we're cheating. We're shortcutting really important law that it protects intermediaries for very important reasons, because if they're not protected, then all of the speech and expression that they enable, all the legitimate speech and expression they enable, is going to be under strain, where that's likely to get taken down too. So it's not that this particular expression is the be all and end all and worth saving and keeping up there. But if we shortcut the law, we can't protect the good stuff.
Great. Excellent points. I think I neglected to put a second MCLE passphrase into the show thus far. Let's remedy that right now. Let's make it Galaga in honor of our War Games discussions earlier on. And we have a tip and a resource for you per usual. The tip is an event. It came my way via email, I think, from a listener. And it looks like a really great event if you're going to be in the New York City area. It's hosted by the New York Foundation for the Arts. It's coming up on September 24th, 2015 at 6 o'clock. And it's going to be a talk by video maker and Emmy Award-winning editor Paul Doherty about his YouTube channel and exactly what we've just been discussing about proper and improper uses of the DMCA and fair use, because Mr. Doherty, I've never seen any of his videos, but I will go check them out now, because it appears that he's done a huge number of videos that have involved the works of other people where he's relying on fair use. So he's been subject to a lot of takedown notices. His channel was actually down for good for quite some time, and he got it reinstated. So it looks like it's going to be a really fascinating talk for anyone interested in the DMCA fair use and mashing up other people's works in your own creative work. So go and check that out if you have the chance. Our resource of the week is by an attorney addressing the issue that many employers, well, first of all, that there were so many .gov and .mil addresses in the Ashley Madison database, and that many employers are sort of doing sweeps to see, you know, how many of their domains are showing up in there and what employees might have been using the site. So this article is squarely addressed at what employers need to be thinking about before they fire any Ashley Madison customers, and is a great checklist of things about how you might want to think twice before, first of all, even searching to see if your people are in there, and secondly, taking action if they are. So hopefully that will be useful to anybody who finds themselves in that situation. And with that, I think we're just about done with our day here at This Week in Law. It's been a really fascinating discussion. I'm so glad you've been able to join us, Michael Lissack, a fascinating business that you're involved in, very interesting creative approaches to some widespread problems. And we really appreciate your taking the time to be on the show.
Well, thank you. And keep in mind, please, this is not a business. We're an educational research institution. Mm-hmm. This is all being done as part of our research and as a nonprofit.
All right.
But again, thank you, Denise.
Good to know, too. The apps aren't free, though, correct?
That is correct. The site is $5 a year unless it's negotiated for by a college or university as a whole. And the anti-bullying app is similarly $5 a year unless a group or a school district is buying it in bulk.
Got it. Thank you so much. I'm sure we'll see more about your apps and this kind of approach to the problems that you're addressing. Kathy Gellis, wonderful to have you on the show for the first time.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Hopefully not the last as well. Okay. Anything going on in your world that you want to let us know about? Any talks or anything in particular you think would be interesting to the audience?
I'm thinking of being involved with Computers Freedom and Privacy, their event in D.C. in mid-October. I think that's the only thing I know of that's brewing right now. I'm particularly interested in doing a lot of more work about all these intermediary issues, because I think there's some – if we like the idea of the democratic ideal of what the internet can enable – making sure intermediaries are protected is really important to make sure that all that speech that they facilitate is protected. And there's a lot of pressures on them to not have that be so. And I'm interested in doing more along those lines, but stay tuned.
Right. And folks should also check out, Kathy did a comprehensive article on the state of the law regarding internet intermediary liability for user-generated content, looking back at the past year, 2014, and synthesizing the many decisions that came out along those lines. So thanks for that. Are you going to do another 2015 one, you think?
I think I didn't do a 2015 because those deadlines have come and gone, but I'm planning to do more in this area. So I'm sure there'll be some published product coming down the pipeline soon. So follow on Twitter, et cetera, read my blog, and you'll hear about stuff.
Right. And again, just check out our show notes if you want a link to the article I mentioned or anything else that we've discussed today. We do the show every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. That's when you can join us live. Jump in the IRC with us. We'd love to have you. But if you can't, don't worry about it. We'll work with your schedule. If you go to twit.tv/twill, you can find any number of ways that you can enjoy the show, whether on your phone or your TV, whether you're in the house or on the go. Many, many ways to enjoy all of our shows here at twit.tv, and they're all discussed there on our show page. Our whole archive of shows is there as well. If you're more of a YouTube person, you can go to youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. It's there too, or at least I think the most recent ones are there on YouTube. We're in iTunes. We're any number of spots that you might likely be looking for this kind of thing. And we'd love it when you get in touch with us. Let us know what you thought about this show, any of our other shows, topics that you think we should take up, people you think it would be interesting to have on, please get in touch with us. Sarah is Sarah P at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. You can find us both on Twitter. The show also has pages on Facebook and Google Plus, community on Google Plus, great places to get in touch and help us brainstorm and develop what we're going to do in the future and follow up on what we've already done. However you join us, we're certainly glad that you do, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.